Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
We also...
Here's John Williams.
Think little baby ones. Hi, it's John. We'll start with one of those in a minute. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio till 3. Ro and Anna will entertain and inform you after that. They always do. Remember, on social media, look for us, WGN King John, on Instagram, on the Twitter, on the Facebook, you know. Lots to do on the show today. Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic at the Tribune, is always a fun conversation. I actually went to a couple of places Phil likes and writes about, my review of his review of those places, in about a half an hour. So how much money do you need to retire? There's been some people writing about that, and there was also a very interesting piece I saw the other day that said, you shouldn't buy a house, you should rent a house if you want to be money smart. Bob Westrick from PrivateVista.com is going to talk to us about that. And Rich Lankoff, the host of Legal Faceoff, will say hi in the 2 o'clock hour. We'll talk about that Tiger Woods lawsuit. It's just kind of a fascinating story, but I'm also curious what happens with dram shop laws in Illinois. If I drink at a bar, you guys serve me too much alcohol, I get in a crash and die, are you in trouble? That's my understanding of dram shop. And, well, that's what happened in Florida in the case of the bartender that worked for Tiger Woods' restaurant. So now he's suing Tiger because, well, his estate is, his family is, because he drank to 3 times the legal limit, got in a crash and died. They said, you guys shouldn't have served him. So what about that? Yesterday on the stream, we talked about electric scooters coming to Chicago in a new transportation share program. The same way we have Divvy bikes, we're now going to have these electric scooters that buzz about. You had 3 options. You could say, hey, I like that idea. And 14% of you do. You could say, well, let's see how it works. And 23% of you said that. And nope, not a fan of that idea. 63% of you nabobs of negativism said, no, you do not want those scooters. Not sure what the new news click is going to be about. You can still move the needle at WGNradio.com on the John Williams page. There's our daily news click. Thomas Jefferson's coming to town. You know, I'm a big Jefferson guy, and I think you should be like me, at least into somebody. Be a Hamilton guy, be a Washington guy, be a Madison guy. We're all, you know, Hillary, Donald Trump, Barack Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton. We tend to maybe cite our allegiances with current or recent presidents, starting with maybe Ronald Reagan going forward. But I think we should all maybe have a deeper or a further appreciation of what this country is all about, going back to the founding fathers. So now I do these conversations with presidents. Sometimes Teddy Roosevelt comes to stage, but on Saturday it's Jefferson's turn. And we'll be at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove, the Classic Cinemas. It's sponsored by our friends at the Joint Relief Institute. Thank you guys for that. By the way, everybody that comes to the show is getting a Bright Side of Life pin. Woohoo! So that's worth $30 right there. The show's about sold out. You can get tickets at WGNradio.com/Jefferson. I really think it's going to be a special conversation given the current politics and just all the fun things to talk to Thomas Jefferson about. Really, it is that. So thank you so much to Steve Sanders and the people over at Channel 9. Was that Steve Sanders that was the anchor? So whoever that was talking to him.
I forgot his name.
On Channel 9 today at 11 o'clock. They were kind enough to do a Skype interview with Thomas Jefferson. And I was a little worried about this because, you know, Skype is not the perfect audio stream, but Jefferson doesn't have a TV studio, so how do you link him up? He's not in town, so they've got to find a way to hook up to him, and they said, well, we'll just use Skype. And that can go well. It can also go badly. I was more worried about their sort of ability to relate to Jefferson. I've seen other people interview my Thomas Jefferson, and sometimes they don't get it or they don't want to do it. And Channel 9 was willing to give him a shot.
John Williams, of course, leading the conversation. I would expect him to try to lead the conversation with you to the politics of today. Can we expect that?
And the video froze.
You're with me, right?
He was, but
I've lost you. I hope you can hear me. John Williams is the best.
Actually, let's keep it. Let's keep it going.
He's absolutely outstanding.
Yeah, I can't hear you. We just can't see.
He's an amazingly intelligent, witty man. He's a centrist. He asks tremendous questions. He doesn't get in the way, as so many radio talk show hosts do. There's no one I would rather work with than the great John Williams.
How about
so
that?
So what would Jefferson say about the politics of today and the political divisions?
That's it. That's the money question.
What would Jefferson say?
I don't know.
I think we've lost you.
Oh!
This May 18th.
It's called... We were that close. He was just about to deliver the goods. He was going to cross the end zone. He was going to say something really interesting and insightful and maybe even provocative about what Jefferson would say about the politics today. And then it went...
No amount of advice can help those kind of problems.
And we prepped him for this.
I know.
Yesterday on the stream, we had Jefferson and we said, listen, we've got a radio host and news anchor here who knows how to do TV. We were speaking about one Lauren Lapka. And so you gave him a lot of good advice.
I felt that it was pretty good. And luckily, didn't even matter.
He didn't even need it because it went,
missed
it by that much. But again, thanks to the folks over at Channel 9. They got the graphic up. They said, here's how to get tickets. And so you can. Good try. Good try, everybody. Where is the story about the honey on the highway?
Oh, yeah, the overturned semi.
That's in Indiana, right?
I-80-94 at Calumet.
Yeah. You heard what the state trooper said when he came upon the scene.
I'm waiting for the punchline.
I know. So text us your punchline. The police officer came upon the scene and he said, text your answer to 312-981-7200. The best response gets a Lou Malnati's pizza. So what's the backdrop on the story? What's happened over there?
Well, this has been an issue for a few hours now, but it's still leaking the amber honey that it was carrying as well as diesel fuel. So it's still blocking two left lanes at Calumet. So traffic is definitely way backed up on I-80-94 East, but it's also backed up on the Tri-State and just on I-80 East all the way to I-57. So it's a mess. It's just a mess.
Said the state trooper, well, if anybody needs flies, we're going to have... if anybody needs flies, we've got them. Do you get that?
So what's the text number again, John? Maybe people will text in some funny stuff.
We sure got a lot of flies here. Hey, who's got a swatter? You know, the flies with honey thing?
Mine was just sweet Jesus.
I've got a lot of people texting in, actually, with the answer.
You make it sound like there's a correct answer.
Or whatever the state trooper said.
What did the state trooper say, Ella?
And they're all saying one thing, which I said to you in the office before I read the story.
Okay, but let's aim a little higher, folks, because we're all saying what?
This is a sticky situation.
Okay. Now, let's come up with a better one. Even I knew that one.
Like the fly thing is...
So just think about it. The state trooper comes up and goes, boy, if anybody needs flies, we're going to have them.
But why is that again? Because flies are drawn to honey?
I shouldn't have to explain the joke, Steve.
Oh, my God, wait.
A funny punchline is just poured in.
847 says, police are on the lookout for a bear with no pants.
That'd be Winnie the Pooh?
Mm-hmm.
Police are on the lookout for a bear with no pants. Now that's...
Now, take it a step further,
that's
because
adorable.
What kind of honey is it, Lauren?
Amber.
You could make it an amber alert for a bear with no pants.
Oh! That's good.
Steve may be getting himself a Lou Malnati's pizza.
How about from 847? The drivers on this highway are going to be angry. It works on writing, not so much in spoken
word. Yeah, sometimes tweets and texts don't always translate. Well, at least we won't have to worry about flies around here now, said a state trooper. There's a flies punchline in there. Let me just tell you that. That's the saying. You say honey, you attract a lot more flies with honey. So we're that close to a really funny punchline.
You attract more flies with honey?
That's a saying, Steve. People use it sometimes.
Is that the exact saying? Because I think you're close to it, but
you can catch. I think you can catch a lot. You catch a lot more flies
with honey.
Honey.
There you go.
That's
yeah.
what you tell your kids when they're wanting to get something accomplished. Well, you attract more flies with honey. Yeah.
Yes. How about holy waffles from 815?
Holy waffles. So just keep them coming, kids. One of you is going to win a pizza. Maybe Steve Bertrand. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. Just before we started at 1 o'clock on this show, and that is a David Fahrenholt story in the Washington Post today. The Chicago Tribune has put it on their front page digitally. It'll probably appear in print there tomorrow, too. Trump's prized Doral Resort is in steep decline, according to company documents showing his business problems are mounting. It's a story about the Trump properties and how they're doing these days. This is not a conversation to pick on Donald Trump or his properties. It's not. But if you go more than halfway through the story, the author of this, Fahrenholt, writes, "Being president has cost me a fortune, a tremendous fortune, like you've never seen before," Trump told reporters last year, rejecting the idea that he was using his presidency to enrich himself. By the end of 2018, the Trump hotel chain had lost three locations as building owners cut ties with the Trump company. Revenue fell at other Trump hotels in Chicago and New York after Trump entered the presidential race. In a statement about its Chicago property, the big Trump Tower here downtown Chicago, the Trump organization said the name was not the reason they were losing money. "It's sad to say," they said, "but the perceived threat of gun violence has harmed visitation to the destination." By the company's own figures, submitted to Cook County, Illinois for tax purposes and given to Trump investors, they show Trump's competitors in Chicago have not experienced the same decline. Among the hotel community in Chicago, everyone is aware of the relative underperformance of the Trump Hotel over the last 2 to 3 years, said a hotel industry analyst based in Chicago. So if it really is our perceived gun violence problem, then all of the hotels, the London House across the river, should be experiencing similar declines.
Chicago set a record with 58 million tourists last year.
David Fahrenholt wrote about this in Washington Post. I think... okay, so there's two things that are going on here. One is the Trump name, and is that more of a problem? The other one is, does the perception of gun violence hurt Chicago as a destination? I absolutely think in the second case it does. I do think the perception of gun violence keeps people from wanting to come to the city. You don't agree with that, Steve?
I don't know. I mean, if it's an absolute, does it help or does it hurt? It certainly doesn't help. So if it keeps one person away or 20 people away, does it hurt? Then, yeah, I guess it would hurt. It's too bad.
David Fahrenholt from the Washington Post is on a phone line. Hi, David. We're talking about your story in Chicago today.
I'm very glad.
Yeah. Jump into the conversation. I mean, what do you want to add right now?
Well, I was surprised. So one of the things we did was we asked, we've been gathering data, including some from Cook County, about the performance of various Trump properties. And when we went to the Trump organization, they had a lot of different excuses for different places. You know, they didn't want to blame the Trump name for the decline in any of them, even in places like Chicago, where obviously there's a lot of, it's a very blue area, and there could be some people turning away from the Trump brand. So in Miami, they blamed Zika and hurricanes. In, you know, in New York City, they blamed weather. And in Chicago, they blamed gun violence, which, as you said, you know, it's obviously something that Chicago has contended with, but I think one of you said this, Chicago has seen an increase in tourism. And more importantly, if you look at the sort of competitive set, what they call the competitive set for Trump's hotel, the other luxury hotels in downtown Chicago that it sees as its main competitors, for those hotels, the metrics of success went up. They got more for their rooms. They had more people staying there. At the same time, it was going down at Trump's place. So you think if gun violence was driving people away from Chicago, it might affect all of them equally, and we don't see that.
What do you think, then, is causing revenue at his hotel in Chicago to decline?
Well, I think there's a couple of factors. One, the Trump Hotel is already at a bad place in the hotel market because it doesn't have a rewards program. I mean, forget if Trump's president or not. it doesn't have Marriott points, it doesn't have Hilton points, it has Trump points, which is not very useful. So it's already at a disadvantage in the hotel market as the hotel market becomes more consolidated. And then you add Trump's name. There's a lot of people who just aren't, you know, if they have to take an extra step to stay at a Trump hotel, now they're not. It's important to know that the clientele that Trump was going for before he ran for president was people who lived in blue cities, people who were like rich urban people who wanted to stay at a hip, cool urban place. And those are exactly the people he sort of run against as a politician. So to me, it's not surprising that he would lose some of that clientele.
You're probably aware of the fact that in promotional materials, the hotel now no longer describes it as the Trump Hotel. They'll put the address on it, but they don't brand it that way.
I saw that. They've got that unused space that goes down to the river, kind of in a weird part of the Riverwalk that's cut off from everything else. And they've been trying to rent out that retail space forever. And as you said, in the brochures they put out trying to attract tenants, they said, oh, it's just 401 North Wabash. They didn't say anything about the Trump Hotel.
But why did
that... someone would rent that space and not know, you know, not ever come look at it.
Oh, no! But but I think it's an attractive space. I mean, you described it as a weird space. If had it been flourishing, I think we would have thought, yeah, no kidding. It's right across from the Riverwalk or on the north side of the Riverwalk.
But it's not a natural spot that you would walk by.
I guess not. But if you were a retailer and you were selling something to either the residents of the hotel or the building or, I don't know, is that a bad location?
I mean, the rest of the Riverwalk is so busy. You think this is, as you said, kind of an inconvenient part of the Riverwalk compared to others. But, you know, it's in downtown Chicago. You think it wouldn't be impossible. It's funny, the Trump organization, in its dealings with Cook County, as it tries to get a reduction in its taxes, has described that space as virtually unleasable. They claim they built it, and they just can't get anybody to stay there for any price.
Starbucks? Are you kidding me? I mean, I don't know. Right. It just seems to me like there's some destination locations that... Were they there and there wasn't something else repelling people, they would be somewhat successful. Heck, lower the rent then. It's a bad sign to see that empty space right on the ground floor.
It is. It's right next to, there's a place where the boats pull up to do the river tours. Yep. I mean, there's traffic near it, so you'd think it wouldn't be impossible to get people over there. But it's never been rented. When the building opened, it's never been rented.
I wonder if I know the answer to this, but let me just finish this thought. So the letters TRUMP appear in giant size across the front of it. It's against city code, but the city relaxed that when Trump said he wanted to put the thing in. Now it's either a great sign for the president or an eyesore, depending on your politics. But maybe everybody would benefit if the letters came down. But that's and I'm kind of surprised that there isn't some grassroots or city council effort to rescind that concession they gave to the Trump people.
It is interesting, but I think they realize that it might be hard to undo something like that. You know, it's funny, the building is managed by Trump, but in theory it is not owned by him. It is owned by the association of people who, you know, condo owners for the residential condos and people who own the hotel rooms as condos. And that association, I think, could decide to do whatever they want. They could decide to take the name down, but it's pretty stocked with Trump loyalists, and that doesn't seem like it's going to change.
David, did you look at condo sales? Because I know they were lagging for a while, but then picked up at the end of last year, the theory that they were hurting sales, but I don't know if that's true.
You're right. It's been kind of up and down. For a few years, I think starting in 2016, Trump condo sales in terms of like price per square foot were much lower than competitors in Chicago. I think last year, as you're right, the numbers went up, but there weren't that many condo sales, and one of them was very, very expensive. So the small sample size may make it hard to tell really what's happening there.
Fascinating piece in the Washington Post, online at the Chicago Tribune site today, too, David Fahrenthold. David, it's nice to talk to you. I hope you can join us again sometime.
I'd love to.
Well done, sir. Phil Vitale's here, restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. Hey, Steve.
John.
Did you hear that a tanker truck of honey crashed on a highway in Indiana and spilled honey all over the street?
I had heard that, John, yes. What did the trooper say when he pulled up?
You know what the trooper said when he pulled up, Steve?
I don't, John. What did the trooper say when he pulled up?
He said, honey, I'm going to be late.
How many entries have you had?
About 100.
And that's the one that got pulled?
Well,
I mean, it's funny.
Hi, Phil Vitale.
Hi there. I had a similar one, so...
What's yours?
Honey, I'm going to be late. I just told you why.
That's good. That's good.
Now that's I like that. The next step.
Yeah, right. Like... Went a little Bob Newhart on it.
Exactly.
Did you just hit the rim shot or did I?
I did.
Okay.
Did you too?
Well, I had and I thought it lagged and just played right then, so that would have been funnier.
847 texted in, my commanding officer just sent in my honey-do list.
All right.
I liked the, this gives new definition to being stuck in traffic.
Mm-hmm. Not bad.
Very good. How about this? 573, what's the buzz? I've heard there's a sticky situation, but we'll comb through it for the answers.
I like that one, too.
Nothing to see here. Nothing.
Got it. Nice.
Be working overtime today. That was a giggle from Lauren Lafferty.
I like that.
Elif?
You want me to give some, or did you want me to finish what I was saying?
Oh, I'm sorry. Either way, it's an open microphone. There's no rules here.
Holy honey on the highway. 847.
All right.
I don't get it, but I like it. Holy honey.
I don't
on the
get
highway.
It either, but.
It's just a pleasant alliteration. It's kind of fun.
Little, that's why.
Yeah, just kind of fun.
Just a little boy wonder expression.
How about from 773? Oh, sweet.
This from 847. Backup help is making a beeline.
Ba-doom.
Oh, we could go on like this.
I need some toasted English muffins. Stat.
847 in parentheses. Oh my. Finish parentheses. God save the queen. Wait, what?
Queen bee.
Oh, God save the queen. Right, I get it.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Well, somebody said if you say this with a British accent, this will work. Oh, beehive.
Nice.
I didn't get that when I copied and pasted
That's
that
the trouble when texted punchlines come with instructions.
Where's Pooh Bear when you need him, says 224. I've got another one. Hey, you guys want to hear my punchline?
Everybody wants to hear that punchline.
So the state trooper said, well, let's see here. Okay, here, I'll just say what I have written down. Troopers are also worried about a convoy of milk tanker trucks coming that way.
Milk and honey, land of milk and honey.
So you get it? Because then if the milk tanker trucks were coming, then they would spill too. And boy, we'd really have a lot of
milk. John, we get the flu too, and it's not funny.
Ooh.
So which one wins, guys? And let's exclude mine, because that wouldn't be fair.
All right. Reluctantly, we'll exclude that one.
Which one stood out? Lauren Lapka, the one you especially like? Elif, was one you especially like?
Mine was the, this gives new definition to being stuck in traffic.
Stuck in traffic is nice. I like my commander just sent in my honey-do list.
I like that one, and I like the honey I'll be late.
Well, that's because you came up with
it. No, the short version that someone else came up with.
Actually, yours with the dangling participle was nice. Okay, well, Elif, why don't you just randomly pick one?
You're giving me that task?
I think all of these are equally good.
I've read
good.
So many.
You may take your trophies home. They're all about the same.
Not one baklava joke. Shocked.
Wow.
Shocked.
Now I have to go back and reread all of these.
No, you don't. Just pick one. Thank you, everybody,
okay,
for texting
then,
in.
Then I'm going to go with the one that I said before. Actually, I didn't say it, I don't think. I just deleted it, and I have to get it back, so give me 30 seconds.
Pins and needles.
30 seconds will be 31 seconds too much for this bit. Randomly pick one or pick one you like and let us know what it is. In the meantime, hi, Phil Vitale.
Hi, John.
Restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune. How are you?
I am fine.
Mon Ami Gabi. You also like ABBA.
Yes. Well, there you go. You have one very, very old and established concept in Mon Ami Gabi, and you have one that's barely a year and change old in
just
ABBA.
About a year old in ABBA, which is a Mediterranean restaurant owned by the Let Us Entertain You group. We were there at ABBA last night.
Ah, yeah. You got in.
Yeah, we did. Friends of ours, the Manfredinis, made reservations like years ago.
Right.
But I also found this out. If you go into that restaurant and sit at the bar, that's kind of first come, first serve.
Yes.
You can eat there.
Yes, you can.
And my understanding is that the terrace they have there, if you want to sit outside, is also first come, first serve.
Right. Very few places reserve their outdoor terraces because if it rains now, what do you do?
So, right.
So they leave it. Well, they leave that as a first come, first serve. However, at ABBA, first come, first serve is 4:45. That's when people start hitting the door.
Well, so we tried it, and we just thought it was really nice.
It is. It's
really
very good.
Yeah. It's small plates, Phil.
Right, small plates, heavy Mediterranean, Middle Eastern kind of dishes, much like Ema in River North, which is the same chef, C.J. Jacobson.
And the difference at ABBA, besides that splendiferous outdoor environment and the fact that it's in the heart of the Fulton Market District, is that there's a little more meat, a little more protein at ABBA.
Yeah, chicken and beef and stuff like that. It was all really good. And so this criticism I have isn't of that place, but it's of that concept, which seems to be everywhere. Any new restaurant now is small shared plate,
yep.
which comes out at the chef's convenience as well.
Yeah, that so, I don't like.
So I got, but I'm supposed to share my stuff, and I didn't want to share my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just that issue to deal with, I guess, when you go to a place like that.
When I'm with more than one other person, I usually they'll say, and then we have our dates. Okay, how many stuffed dates are we talking about? There are three. Because there are always three. The chefs don't like even numbers. And there's four of us. Said, okay, what are we going to do? Can we get a fourth one on there? Charge me what you want, but I'm not going to take 75% out of each date and then distribute it.
And the idea of shared plates, too, to me, if you were going to share a plate with four, as we were, then there should be enough on the plate to really share with
right.
four. We're not sharing so much as we're just tasting.
Exactly.
We're nibbling. What we were nibbling and tasting was really good, but... I would like more on the shared plate.
Exactly.
I was also pleased with the price. I thought new hot restaurant, blah, blah, great location, great view, all of that. All of that is great. I thought this is going to be expensive. And we had some cocktails and wine, too. I mean, we did it the way we wanted to do it. It wasn't so pricey at all. I was pleased.
I thought it was pretty fair. Not to give them any ideas, they could probably tick everything up 15% and get away with it.
I think you're totally right about ABBA, the Mediterranean restaurant in the Fulton Market District. By the way, Olive?
Yeah, my question relates to what you just said. Why don't they ever put even-numbered... food items on the plate?
Well, from a design standpoint, you've heard of the rule of three, in which just arrangements of three are somehow infinitely more pleasing to the eye without even realizing it.
Yeah, but that works for pictures on a wall or chairs in a room, but they actually think about the plate decor that way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They like to look at things in thirds and how you're going to do this. And they actually, you'd be amazed when they start putting a menu together how many different ways they'll plate a certain dish before they say, boom, that's the one I want to send out.
You reviewed a new restaurant today and gave it 3 stars.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this.
Okay. It's Momotaro. It has been around for a while, but not since, not Chef Gene Kato, who was the new chef at Momotaro, and thus my return. Gene Kato was previously at Japan A, which is a very nice restaurant once upon a time. He had his own place, Sumi Rubata Bar, which closed a year ago, and now he has taken the helm at Momotaro. Gene Kato does great in Japanese cuisine, but he's more on the hot prepared end rather than the sushi end, which he, of course, oversees, but he has his own sushi chef doing that work.
Got it.
So when I go to Momotaro and I want to have Gene's food, I'm going right for the hot dishes, particularly the Rubata dishes, which are usually skewers cooked over special charcoal on a very hot, very small grill.
They don't do that at your table, though.
There is one option. Well, you do it at your table.
Yeah, I don't want to do it at my table. I want you to do it at my table.
Exactly.
I don't even want you to do it at my table. I want you to do it and bring it to my table.
Mm-hmm.
They do that, too, right?
Oh, they do that more than they do the other thing. The advantage of having it at your table is that you get to inhale more of that great charcoal smoke.
I guess you get it as hot as it can be then, too. There's no delay between it being cooked and then getting to your table and it cooling off.
No, in fact, you can burn your tongue if you feel like it.
So just tell me more about the menu and the food you had.
Okay, on the Rubata Bar, again, skewered, if you're not feeling adventurous, there are chicken meatballs, which are really, really good, some shiso marinated chicken thighs, something called a chicken oyster, which is actually the back muscle of the chicken that not that many people make anything out of. They cut up real nice. But I like what they do with things like gyutan, which not everybody goes in for because it's beef tongue. but this is Wagyu beef tongue, and when you think about Wagyu beef, you think of steaks and all the rest of it, but Wagyu is a whole cow, so what are you going to do with the rest of the cow parts? Well, this is the most tender, flavorful tongue you're ever going to
try. Does cow tongue taste like beef, or does it taste like something else?
It tastes like beef, and whatever they've happened to season it with.
I would prefer them then to serve it to me and not tell me that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do list it as gyutan, but there is a it does. But they do tell you
exactly. You know, this reminds me a little bit of when we were in Scotland last week and we had haggis, and I don't know how good it was because I just could not get it out of my head that I was eating haggis.
Right.
It may have been good, but my brain had already was so scrambled about it. I had no way to, you know, sort of legitimately taste the food. I was too messed up just going in.
What about oatmeal porridgey thing inside of a sheep's bladder is bothering you?
That's pretty much it, my friend.
Pretty much it, yeah.
And people in our group who weren't so squeamish said it was pretty good.
Uh-huh. If you'd had it deep fried, it would have been a wholly different experience for you.
Meaning what?
Because they serve it. I've had it deep fried, like in little nuggets for an appetizer, things like that.
Yeah. So what's the but then are you really having haggis then?
I don't know what you're having?
You're just having having fried oil on a thing, right?
Well, I mean, you take your medicine wrapped in peanut butter. You're still taking your medicine.
Okay, John, you lost me because Rodney Dangerfield in the movie Back to School. I hate small plates. John, ask Phil for mid-price dinner places in the Oak Brook area. We're hosting some out-of-town guests. Before you do that, let's wrap up your review of a Momotaro.
Momotaro. It's actually the name of a tomato.
It's three
Fun
stars.
Fun fact.
Which is a very good rating for you, 3 stars. Is that an expensive place in the Fulton District?
You know, the hot and cold dishes, they vary in size to get back to the small plate thing. So, but the most expensive thing on the menu is probably about $26, and everything goes down to little bites. You know, your edamame will cost you $8 or whatever. So, it's like Abba in a way that, depending, you can go deep dive and try a whole bunch of stuff and really ratchet the bill up. But you can also have just a couple of 3 plates and a glass of wine or a glass of sake and call it a night.
Yeah, cocktails good.
Cocktails are very good. They have a very good beverage director there, and she does what was the one I liked so much? There's something called Smoky Plummy Boozy, and it's got a little mezcal in there.
Those are three of my favorite words.
My three favorite dwarfs, actually. You
smoky,
never hear from them. Boozy, yeah.
Boozy took Smoky and Plummy out. And
left on the director's and cutting room floor, but they really added a lot to the canon, I thought.
At 8:30 West Lake. 8:30 West Lake, Momotaro. Okay, some text for you. Let's do Phil's Flash Fry, too, shall we?
Mm.
This is where we ask you to tell us what is that one food you really like at that one place. 312-981-7200. It's not a game or a contest. We just like to know if you were recommending one food at one place, you would say, oh, you got to try the this at the that. What is it and where is it? And Phil usually has an observation about it. It's kind of fun. We'll do that next on WGN.
I'm going to deround my vegetables. I'm going to chop down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite.
Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune. This is Phil's Flash Fry.
I love you.
So what do you love? What do you want Phil to comment on? John, in DeKalb, you have to have the fried Cajun potato salad at Fatty's. Okay, I don't know what I just said, but that sounds kind of good, doesn't it? A fried Cajun potato salad at Fatty's.
Wow.
Put that on your list of to-do, okay?
Yes.
John, we are hosting people from out of town in the Oak Brook area. Could you give us some mid-price dinner places in the Oak Brook area? What do you like there?
In the mall, I like Antico Posto quite a bit. That's nice, rustic Italian, good wine list, good for some bites and appetizers.
And the oil and garlic they give you, or whatever that is,
mm-hmm.
for your bread when you walk in, is to die for.
Yeah,
oh, my God, is that good.
It's really good stuff. We mentioned off the air Redstone Grill, which isn't that far away.
Redstone's nice, too.
They do a nice job. And then further down, there's a place right off 31st Street called Parker's Ocean Grill, which is a seafood place, surprising. And it's a nice place. It's... They have Neapolitan pizzas. I mean, they actually went and got certified and all the rest of
that
stuff.
Yeah.
So they take it pretty seriously. And, of course, seafood.
John, the fried chicken tenders with the house dipping sauce and the nachos at Village Tavern in Schaumburg or Carroll Stream are to die for. Okay? That's nice. Thank you for that. And, Patrick, you're on WGN. And what did you want Phil to comment on? You're on the air.
John, have you ever tried the calamari at Gatto's restaurant?
Gatto's or G-A...
Yeah, Gatto's. Are we talking about the one in Downers Grove?
Yeah, there's one in Downers Grove. There's one in Tinley, Orland, and New Lenox as well.
Ah, I didn't know that. I have, but it was a long, long time ago. I'm usually more a fan of grilled calamari than fried calamari, honestly. But they have a lot of pastas on the menu. I tend to gravitate toward that.
Thank you for the call. Not bad, though, huh?
Mm.
John, have you ever been to Ottomo's in Orland Park? Automos in Orland Park.
Yes, that's Patrick Concannon's place. It's been there for about, got to be there at least 5 years now. It's a very good restaurant. It's right next to this little Mexican place that's also Patrick's. Patrick's family owns Don Juan's up in Edison Park.
Yeah.
It's a good place.
Fair enough. Orland Park, that's Automos. Just some of the places that you all are texting in about. Ella said, hey, we're out of time.
Oh, no.
We're out of time, Phil Vitale.
Uh-huh.
If you come up with any better punchlines for the honey spill on the highway in Indiana, feel free to text them in.
All right. Traffic's a little sticky on the Borman. No.
Elif, by the way, do we have a winner for our Malnati's Pizza? Who came up with the best one?
It was the person who said, police are looking for a bear with no pants.
All right. That was the best one, I think.
That's the everybody's a winner, but that one gets the pizza.
Yep. Can't Phil, beat a good poo joke.
Phil, you can leave now. We'll talk to you next Wednesday.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
Real big ones.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. We've got some heavy hitters in this hour, thought-wise. We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio until 3 Saturdays. We're on from 10 to noon. This Saturday, I'll be at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove. Thomas Jefferson and I on stage. Come see us. Details on how you can watch me interview the third president of the USA at WGNradio.com/Jefferson. You can get your ticket information there. I should play one more time what it was like when Jefferson was on Channel 9's News Today at 11 o'clock this morning. They were so kind as to give TJ some time, and he was on Skype. He was cutting in and out a little bit, and I was worried that technically it might not go well, to say nothing of the content itself, like what's he going to say and are they going to get it? And right when they said, so what would Jefferson say about the politics of today, which is the whole nut, that's the enchilada, that's why he's coming to Chicago, the Skype went, and I laughed out loud. I laughed out loud. Elif said, do you think you jinxed it? And I said, yes, I think I did.
So were you hoping for it to fail?
That's what she said, too. And I thought, what do you mean? Why am I hoping it to fail?
Well, you sound like you enjoyed when it did.
I did. Which I know makes no sense.
That doesn't make a lot of sense.
Enjoy. So, WGNradio.com/Jefferson. There were a couple of articles that caught my eye lately. They were in the financial sector, and so I thought I'd ask Bob Westrick to come in. You've met Bob before on this radio show. He is a partner with Private Vista. They are wealth managers in Chicago. That means planning and investing in Chicago and the suburbs. Bob's been sort of a financial go-to guy for us a lot of times, and we invited him back in the studio. Hi, Bob. How are you?
Doing well, John. Thank you.
Isn't it a coincidence that every time you come on, it seems, somebody's just won the lottery, and there's big lottery news. That guy in Wisconsin who won, what was it, Elif, like $740 million? $704 million was going into Target stores with gift cards, $200 gift cards, just because he used to work at a Target. And he was just coming up to people going, here's $200. You know what most people did?
Said thank you?
They said no thank you. They said they thought it was some sort of scam. They were skeptical of him coming up.
Wow.
Which I sort of understand, right? Because nobody does that. But this guy was doing it, and there's a story in the Tribune today about one woman who said thank you and took the $200. I think she was buying diapers or something. And that's what I would do. I would love to win the lottery and then be that guy. I would probably get mugged a lot. But he took his 700 and some million dollars as a one lump sum, which I always advise against. I think you should take it as a 20-year annuity. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I don't think you should be giving financial advice, John, to a lot of winners.
Right.
That aside, typically when you run the numbers, it's definitely in your to your advantage to take a lump sum, because they discount that lump sum at such a low interest rate typically that while it's great for discipline reasons, you know, you're not going to run out of money, and that's great, John, for a lot of people.
Thank you.
That's a wonderful thing for a lot of people, because a lot of folks who win, let's say, $1 million, $2, $3 million, they blow it all. They're like, I'm rich. I can buy anything. And they buy a couple houses, a car, whatever, and all of a sudden they have no money. And to your point, they would have been a lot better off just taking the annuity.
So, right. So what would you advise me to do? What would you advise a guy to do?
Well, it depends who the guy is. I mean, if it's somebody who's somewhat sophisticated and as a financial advisor, then I would absolutely say take the lump sum. If it was me, I would absolutely, hands down, take the lump sum.
Yeah.
But for a lot of folks who win, let's say, $1 million, $2, $3 million, who might have just been, not real disciplined with their spending or savings, then
or
they should definitely
never had
take
that,
the annuity.
Or never had that kind of money. I mean, it's like suddenly you've got to speak in a foreign language. You just don't know what this is like. And here's the advantage to the person who takes it over 20 years. When someone comes up and goes, hey, we're going to open up a sushi joint in Lamont. What do you say? You can say, you know what, I'm tapped out. Check with me in another year. Check with me in a few more years because I didn't get it all. I only got a couple $1 million right now. So over 20 years, it sort of, I think, wards off would-be suitors of your money because you don't have it right now. You
True.
Couldn't blow it if you wanted.
True. Of course, that guy from Wisconsin would be getting about $30, $40 million a year and probably could help you with that piece of place. But
no, it's a sushi place in Lamont.
He could help you with both.
So there's a story in the paper. It says that it was written by a woman in St. Louis. Vittert was her last name, right? And she said that if you are thinking about buying a house, you're probably better off renting. Liberty Vittert is her name. And this was on FoxNews.com, a statistician's new take on the old question about renting or buying. She says, from the time we're little kids, we're told by our caring parents, save up so you can buy that house. And a lot of us have done that. I don't think that equation has changed. You have equity. You get a tax deduction. You have a place maybe to live someday, or at least it's a good place to park money. As it gets more valuable, your asset grows, and then when you sell it, you're able to cash in. I can't think of any reason to rent. And then she goes through this whole article and pops every bubble about that. Without reading the whole article on the air, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I read the article. Some of her assumptions that she makes are very, very valid, and some of her conclusions are valid, too. However, you know what? Like any other sort of rule of thumb, if you're thinking about buying versus selling or renting versus buying, you really have to look at your own situation. You know, how much would the place that you're going to buy be versus the place that you're going to rent? Also, how long do you think you're going to be in that place? If it's going to be like 1 to 3 years, you should probably just rent because there's been a lot of transaction costs in the buying and selling that are going to be hard to overcome. But in over 7, 8 years, you're probably going to be better owning. You know, but in that maybe, 4 to 6 year period, you just have to decide whether it's worth to you to take a little bit of risk on the on your house appreciation or depreciation, versus renting.
Well, and what are you going to do with the money that you're saving? If the rent is $500, but the mortgage is $1,000, either way, if you're going to rent and in theory save $500, then presumably you're going to do something with that other $500. You're going
right.
to invest it.
Right.
And she said that probably you'll do just as well in the market, maybe better, with your extra money than putting it into a mortgage.
Yeah, she didn't really say that. She had said that with that extra money you invested over 30 years, at 5%, you'd have about $250,000. Okay, and the house that you bought, the hypothetical house, was $200,000, and it only takes 0.75% annual appreciation to get to that $250,000 equivalent. And if you just have a 2% annualized appreciation of that same $200,000 house, then you're over $485,000 versus that $250,000. So, yeah, you're taking some risk on the appreciation of the house, but you're also taking, in the other case, some risk on the appreciation of the stock market.
In the market or bonds or whatever you put the money in, right?
Right. And the other thing, John, understand that in a lot of things in theory work great and in practice don't. For instance, I'm going to take that extra money I'm not paying on my housing and I'm going to put it into a good mutual fund or something, okay? In theory, great. In practice, I've got more money. I'm going to take a trip to Greece. I'm going to buy a nicer car. I'm going to eat at nicer restaurants. That's kind of what a lot of people do that I know. So if you truly had the discipline, maybe it would be a closer race, but a lot of people don't.
She also cites a bunch of things that we just don't think about when we buy a house outside of the mortgage, insurance, and taxes. She says, what about extra fees associated with the initial purchase, which are 4% sometimes of the purchase price? Annual maintenance, she says, is 1.5%. I think she's just making these numbers up, but let's let her have it.
Sure.
Renovation, 1%. Homeowner's insurance, 1%. Property taxes, 1%. Dreaded, unexpected, but inevitable, unforeseen costs. Yeah, there's expenses when you own a home. I guess we all know that. Some of us address those more deliberately than others. But is that enough to keep you from buying a house? I I would hope not. I'm just and, old you know, school about this.
And frankly, John, I don't really know anyone yet, and I'm not saying some people haven't, actually done a cost benefit between renting and buying. I mean, folks generally, they're buying a home because they want stability. They want to form community. They want to be there for a while. They want to be able to paint a wall and not have to call the landlord. They want to be sure that they can live in the same house that maybe their kids are in. And after 3 years, the landlord doesn't say, you know what, I sold your house to somebody else. You got to get out. You know, so there's a lot of other reasons that are non-financial to make that decision of renting versus buying.
Well, I'm glad you said that because really, I mean, it's your money. You get to do whatever you want with it. And if doing this makes you happy, isn't that the end game? Isn't that the object of the game? I have a friend I know who has never been that deliberate about his career as some of us have. And as a result, he hasn't had as much money. And as a result, his house hasn't always been repaired the way maybe he'd wanted. And he also seems to have more free time, and he seems to be enjoying life a lot more than those of us who are running as fast as we can on the treadmill. I've looked at him sometimes, and I thought, maybe I've got it wrong. You know, he seems to be enjoying his life. That's a lot to just say what you said about renting versus buying. If the house makes you happier, then maybe that's almost reason enough to be a home buyer versus a home renter.
Certainly. I mean, when we, I don't know about you, John, but when we bought our house, I mean, we never even thought about, oh, what would be financially optimal, renting versus buying. We wanted to find a spot that we were comfortable with, it felt safe, it had good schools, good community, good churches, you know, good restaurants, of course, you know, and a place where our children could feel like this is home. So
there's also a story in MotleyFool.com, and I saw another story like this week, and that was $1 million may not be enough. That's the golden number, I think, for people. Would you agree with me on that, Bob? If I have $1 million, I'll be able to retire someday.
Well, I think that maybe a lot of people think that, but I mean, we've got 1,000 clients, and you know, $1 million for one is vastly not enough, and $1 million for others is plenty.
Most people don't have $1 million in retirement funds.
That's true.
Not even close That's to true. That. And the number of people who have pensions that are going to make up some sort of difference is a lot less than it used to be as well. So just talk to me about how I'm going to come up with a number, if you even like that concept. In a minute. It's 2:20. We're talking to Bob Westrick. He is a partner at Private Vista. Bob Westrick is a partner at Private Vista. We're talking about things financial, by the way, with Bob. And there's a couple articles in the news lately. I wanted Bob's views on it, so there we are. $1 million, Bob.
Yes.
The golden number that a lot of people, I think, aspire to when they retire someday. And then here's the Motley Fool saying the $1 million myth, why $1 million may not be enough in retirement. I don't see how it's not. If you have $1 million and then you say, okay, I'll just put that somewhere and get 4% interest, then I'll get $40,000 a year. And then every year I'll have $40,000. That with Social Security or pension or whatever else you'll cobble together, you're at $50,000. That's the average income for an American. His household income's around $50,000. So then you're good to go for life. And you don't even touch the principal. Your thoughts?
First of all, another very, very gross rule of thumb, $1 million. Everybody spends differently. You know, for some folks, that's more than enough money, and for some folks, that's not nearly enough for their lifestyle. But to your point, you know, there's that old 4% rule. It's a rule that's been around since 1994. There was a study done, and apparently, you know, you can take, let's say you have $1 million in your very first year of retirement, you take out 4%, you take out $40,000. And then every year you increase that distribution, that withdrawal by inflation, so that your actually buying power never goes down. So in year two, there's been 2% inflation. Now you take out $40,800.
Right.
And so you should be able to buy the same amount of goods and services as before. Last year, the average amount of Social Security, and once again, this is an average, by couples in the United States was $28,000, roughly. Okay, so you go 40,000, 28, you're at $68,000. So bottom line is some people live very, very comfortably on $68,000 and some people don't. So when you ask, you know, is $1 million enough? It's enough for some and not enough for others. So as you know, you have to do the financial planning. You have to find out just really, you know, for me to live an enriched and fulfilling retirement, how much money do I want to spend? And then back into the number.
What about my idea, though, that you don't touch the principal? You just live off the interest.
Well, first of all, this whole interest thing we've talked about many times. And
why do you get mad at me when I say that?
Because I keep telling you why not to say it, yet you persist.
Well, you do put it in a thing that generates interest, right?
Well, what you do is you invest it, John. And the 4% rule is you just take 4% of the total return. Okay. Okay. Interest and dividends are just two of the three components of total appreciation.
I thought the 4% rule was that you would get 4%.
No.
Why not?
No. Well, there's no 4%, you know, guarantee really that you can get. And let's say you do get 4%, John. So now you get, your $40,000 just the way John Williams wants to do it. And now 10 years from now, you're still getting $40,000. But, you know, the gallon of gas that you were paying for, now instead of costing $4, costs $5.
Yeah.
Okay, and everything costs more. So bottom line is every year you can afford less and less and less and less.
And I'm saying $1 million only because I think that's a ballpark that everybody wants to achieve. Some people have, most people won't, and certainly right now don't. But I guess this same conversation applies to people who have $100,000 in savings for retirement.
Right.
Whatever the amount is.
Right. And the thing is, John, is once again, you have to calculate what that number is in order to generate enough income for you to live the life that you want to live. Okay? But the bottom line is, if you don't want that 100,000 or million or 10 million to run out, okay, just the first rule of thumb, and if you're investing in roughly a portfolio of 60% stocks and 40% bonds, is that you probably don't want to take out more than 4% initially, and then every year thereafter, more than that amount plus inflation.
So however much money you're able to save, just imagine that the most you're ever going to pull out is 4%. Is that the rule of thumb we're at least talking about here?
4% in the very first year, and then you increase
inflation.
It by inflation.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, I'm out of time, Elif said. Which is a shame, because I thought I was on a roll there, Bob, with that interest thing. I thought I was really making some ground there.
Yeah, you're actually backtracking a little bit. but I like what you're thinking.
Yeah, all right. So the company is called Private Vista. The website is myprivatevista.com. I appreciate you coming in, Bob.
Thank you, John.
Next time I have some... if nothing else, you dissuade me of some of my harebrained financial ideas from the lottery on down. So I appreciate you coming in for that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Bob Westrick. You've probably been hearing this story. The family of a Florida man who purportedly was drunk when he crashed his car is suing Tiger Woods, his girlfriend, who manages the restaurant, and Tiger's restaurant company, saying they should have prevented the man from drinking too much and driving to his death. Nicholas Immisberger was 24. He died in December near the community of Port Salerno, about 20 miles from Tiger Woods' Jupiter restaurant bar, when he crashed his Corvette. The lawsuit blames Woods, who owns the restaurant where Immisberger worked as a bartender, and Erica Herman, who is listed as listed in the complaint as the general manager of the business. They're blaming the two of them and the restaurant essentially for the wrongful death of a man whose blood alcohol level was 0.256, more than three times the legal limit there. He was doing 70 and a 55, lost control of his car and died. Now, they say they're bringing it up now or making it public because they say the restaurant has destroyed evidence about him drinking, video of him, say, at that restaurant. But I think we can ignore that fact for a moment and just talk about what happened here. Rich Lenkoff, who you hear frequently on WGN Radio and has a podcast here called Legal Face Off, is in our studio. Hi, Rich. Welcome back. How you
Thank been? You, John. Doing well.
What's your reaction to this story?
Well, you know, as a defense lawyer, putting aside my role as a legal analyst, as a defense lawyer who actually represents a lot of restaurants and bars, my reaction is that this is a case about personal responsibility. Think a lot of the reaction has been, why would the victim, not the victim, but why would the decedent's family sue for something that this young man decided to do on his own? In other words, he wasn't forced to drink, right? He drank on his own, decided on his own to get into a car and drive, and, you know, suffered fatal injuries as a result. That's in my role as a defense lawyer. As an objective legal analyst, I think that this lawsuit will at least survive what's called a motion for summary judgment, and we'll get to a jury.
Because there is such a thing as dram shop.
Exactly. Dram shop laws in most states govern this type of lawsuit and state that a bar owner, a restaurant owner, a similar establishment can be held liable if it can be proven that, A, they served alcohol to someone, and that person ultimately ended up injuring someone else, or in this case, themselves, as a result of that intoxication. If that can be proven, then you can go after the bar owner, the restaurant owner, for doing that.
And it's liability, not responsibility. So they're not saying that you caused the guy to crash his car. They're saying, though, you have a financial interest in this, and so part of your license is that you're going to have dram shop insurance, and somebody's going to help pay for that.
Right, exactly. And in this case, the allegation is specifically, and according to the Florida statute, the allegation is that the bar owner, the bartender that happens to be Tiger Woods' girlfriend, was aware that this individual was an alcoholic and despite that continued to serve him. I think the complaint talks about, you know, fueling his addiction by continuing to serve him. So they're alleging that they violated the statute because they knew he was an alcoholic. How do they know? The allegation is that, you know, because he was a bartender, he'd been drinking on previous occasions. They knew he was in therapy. Despite that, they continued to serve him in violation of this law.
Okay, well, in that case, it seems to me like the family has a case here.
There's definitely a case. You know, what we always say is you could sue anyone, right? I mean, you could sue anyone for anything. Whether it will result in an award from a jury is a different question. And, you know, usually we look at whether it will survive a motion for summary judgment, which is basically you're asking the court to throw out the case. This will survive that because, to your point, there is enough to meet the standards of the law. The allegation, again, is that they knew he was an alcoholic, served him anyway. Whether that will get an award from a jury is a different question. I mean, you know, I could ask you or your listeners, would you award this person money because the bar was responsible for serving him, or would you feel that he was most at fault for this action? Again, in my role defending a lot of restaurants and bars, I feel like personal responsibility mandates that, you know, he was in control. He could have stopped.
You're framing that as a defense lawyer now.
Absolutely.
Not as a legislator. Not
Correct.
As a neutral party.
Correct.
I mean, because I think everybody heard this story and they went, oh, for God's sakes, this is ridiculous. If you drive drunk, it's not Tiger Woods' fault. You're going after Tiger Woods in a restaurant because blah, blah, blah. And I think that when you hear the details of it, you say, wait, here's an alcoholic that they know who was in their employ, who shouldn't probably be drinking on the property anyway. Some places don't allow it. And now he's been served to intoxication, 0.256. Are you kidding me? And you guys are still serving him drinks? And that's against the law in Florida.
Well, listen, very interesting story. I'm sure you heard of it or covered it. We talked about it on Legal Face-Off last week. There is a similar, this was a criminal case where the bartender was arrested in Plano, Texas last week for failing to do anything and call the police when she was serving this individual who ended up killing eight people. He was in the bar earlier that day. Yeah. He was twirling around his knife. He talked about going out and doing something, and she continued to serve him and didn't call the police. She was arrested for that. You know, so I agree with you. There is some responsibility for a bar owner or a restaurant owner to be aware of your patrons and not serve them. But, you know, the jury will have to determine who's more responsible, the bar or the individual.
And if it wasn't Tiger Woods, but all the other details are the same, it maybe is an entirely different kind of case.
Of course.
I mean, I don't know how the jury will weigh that. I mean, doggone it, just when things were going good for Tiger, and I think America's kind of taking him back under their wing, and now this happens, I could see some sympathy for the Tiger Woods side of this case.
Yeah, and remember, I mean, you know, it was only 2 years ago where we saw a video of Tiger Woods doing a sobriety test on the side of the road, and he was arrested for drunk driving. Now, again, to your point, he's just coming off the Masters Championship. He was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor last week by President Trump, right?
Yeah,
so will a jury look at that and think that I don't want to, you know, hit Tiger with this? Or will they think this is a deep-pocketed individual who, you know, in relation to the family could much more, you know, afford some damages?
We got some calls for this and some texts. 312-981-7200, you can call or text. But just for a second, humor me. Let's not talk about Tiger Woods. Let's talk about I'm drinking at a restaurant or bar in Chicago. I'm not an alcoholic. I leave and I'm intoxicated. I get into a crash. Do people normally then go after the establishment?
Very frequently. Again, the standard in Illinois, as it is in many states, is whether you can prove, you as the plaintiff can prove, that you suffered some injury. So if you were the victim in this car accident, that's easy to prove. And that the driver, the patron, was intoxicated and that intoxication was caused by being served at the bar. So it sounds very legal. It sounds complicated. It's not. Under your scenario, all you'd have to prove is that that person drank at that bar. There used to be in Illinois the standard that the bar had to have some knowledge of it, that they had to have some notice of it. Case law has evolved so that you don't have to prove that anymore.
Okay, so the third party then in this case, then as the drunk driver, I hit somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That somebody may go after me, but
sure,
they could go after the bar as
absolutely
well. Can I go after the bar as the drunk driver? Because, hey, you guys shouldn't have been serving me.
You can. I mean, it's obviously less strong than the victim going after, but yes, you can then, what we call third party in the bar, to bring them into the case.
Lots of texts. Hey, John, why is an alcoholic working as a bartender? 847, he's the bartender, right? Did he or did he not serve himself? I don't know if that matters in this case.
The allegation of the lawsuit says that he was being served, that he was off, you know, after hours, and he was being served by the bar.
Is the restaurant supposed to assume he drove there? Could they have just thought he was going to take an Uber? Right, so he's inebriated, or John Williams is inebriated in Chicago, but how do we know that person's going to drive? They could be a passenger in a vehicle.
Yeah, again, the lawsuit alleges that they should have called him a car, should have called him an Uber, should have offered to drive him home. Again, it's the question of whether the bar has this responsibility to take the extra step.
You know, I got to tell you, if I'm in that jury in Florida, just based on the law, I think I'm going to award the family damages, and that the restaurant is going to have to pay. And people are going to lose their minds when that happens. But as we talk about this right now, that's where my head is. Karen, you're on WGN. What do you want to say?
Yeah, I'm curious as to Illinois law, what with that accident, that little girl, in the 7-year-old in St. Charles. The man driving the truck left the scene. We know that. We've heard that, et cetera. But he's driving a truck that was lent to him, all right? And the person that lent the truck to him had no, yeah, he's doing him a favor. But this guy, you know, 3 DUIs, no insurance. Now, there's going to be huge medical bills. What's the status of that kind of situation, particularly here in Illinois?
I guess it's responsibility versus liability, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's not so much a dram shop situation. Dram shop is generally limited to the types of scenarios we're discussing here, where, you know, business owners are serving patrons. In the situation you're referring to, if someone else loaned him the truck and that truck was involved in an accident, you can go after the loaner, but that would be, you know, that would not be very likely to be successful. The main person that you go after, of course, is, you know, the individual who allegedly perpetuated this crime.
Thanks for the call, Karen. This is Rick. You're on WGN. How are you, Rick? You're on the air.
Hey, John. Thank you. I just want to say, as a bartender in Illinois, the bartenders are not supposed to drink. I know a lot of bar managers look the other way, but it's in our BASSET training that we have. It's BASSET. And also, a lot of managers will turn the other way if someone's drunk, if they're spending money and they're a regular.
I can see that.
That's a big issue in Illinois. I've had to argue with managers on throwing people out of establishments I've worked at because, well, the guy's spending money. And I'm like, doesn't care. What if he gets behind the wheel and kills someone? Then not only does it go back on the establishment, it goes back on me as a bartender as well, and I get arrested.
It's an interesting point, Rick. Thanks for the call. What do you say about
that? Again, in this allegation specifically, they're saying that the bar was complicit. They were aware on many prior occasions. This wasn't the first time that they had served him, that they were aware that he was an alcoholic and that they had done this on many occasions before. They referenced this culture at the bar that the GM was, you know, in favor of this big party scene, it sounds like.
Elif said break. It's 2:51 on WGN, and we've got some terrific calls on this. Ed says insurance covers dram shop laws, and Don said you can't disregard that missing video. All right, we'll hear you out. Rich Lenkoff's in our studio. You hear him frequently on WGN Radio, and don't miss his podcast that he hosts or co-hosts called Legal Face-Off. He's also an attorney at Bryce, Downey, and Lenkoff. We're talking about the Tiger Woods story. We're talking about Illinois stories just like this on WGN. Rich Lenkoff's an attorney. You frequently hear him on WGN Radio. We're talking about that Tiger Woods story, the family of a bartender who worked at a restaurant that Tiger Woods owns is suing Tiger Woods and the restaurant because that young man drove drunk, killed himself. They're holding Tiger and the restaurant liable. We're talking about dram shop in that case, but in Illinois, too. Lots of calls, lots of texts about this. Don, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
Hi, Gavel. First off, just a point of order. Tiger Woods got arrested for drug driving, not drunk driving.
Fair enough.
He'd overtaken his medication.
Yeah.
So in Illinois, though, most restaurants have to carry dram shop insurance coverage, and I believe the damages are capped at a certain amount. I forget what they are now, but it used to be they were capped at $25,000. It may have gone up. Is that still the situation here?
Yeah, there's still limitation for dram shop liability in Illinois, and also the statute of limitations is lower. You've got 1 year to bring a lawsuit versus 2 years for other personal injury types of lawsuits.
I didn't realize that, but I guess, yeah. So it's not like the restaurant's going to go broke because they have to have insurance to cover this. Maybe their premium will go up.
Yeah, and generally, you know, anytime you sue any kind of business, restaurant or bar, they've got insurance, even if it's not specific to dram shop. If, you know, you slip and fall in a restaurant and you sue them, generally they're going to tender that to their carrier.
Ed, thanks for the call. Pardon me, Don, thanks for the call. And I just hung up on Ed. So, although I thought Don was going to say you can't disregard those last 3 hours of video that's missing in the Tiger Woods case.
Yeah, it's a great point, and you referenced it at the top of the story. The allegation is that the restaurant bar had video and destroyed it, which is something I deal with all the time. I mean, it's very common for establishments, for bars, stores, whatever, to have video and not retain it, right? I mean, they're running a business. They're not, you know, running some kind of litigation place where they have to, you know, they're always aware of video. Yeah. Now, they have standards by which they have to adhere, and they have to keep video for a certain time. And the question of whether they destroyed the video on purpose or by accident will be one for the jury. If they succeed, that could lead to additional damages for what's called spoliation of evidence.
We're out of time. I'll just read a last text. Ever tried to cut off a drunk, John? Cut off a drunk? I have, and I thought I was going to get my ass kicked. It's easier said than done. Why are employers somehow responsible for everything? Fair enough. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the text. Rich, thanks for coming in. We'll listen for your podcast. They normally drop on Fridays, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Legal Face-Off.